I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Kuwait.
I was born in Tanzania in a refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala. City.
I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand, refugee
I was
camp.
Born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in England.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads to Here, bringing the voices of immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers to a national conversation about migration and identity. I'm your host, Meg Ritter. The Immigrant Story has been hosting live storytelling events in the Portland, Oregon area since 2019. Today, we bring you the third episode in our series, The Immigrant Story Live, which features stories from the stage stitched together by theme. Many of us have been told who we are, who we should be. Maybe we've been judged for the actions of our parents, the color of our skin, the way our eyes look, the accent someone tells us we have, or for not conforming to expectations of how our gender supposedly should act. Often this judgment comes from our families, our classmates, our colleagues, sometimes from the towns we live in, or cities, or states, or country. We can wonder where we belong, if anywhere, who we are, who we should be, who we want to be. Each of us goes on a journey, some expeditions full of more hurdles and roadblocks than others, many of us hoping to filter out the noise, ask the hard questions, discover the truth, and stay true to what we find, but also to come to peace with the things we cannot change. Our three storytellers in today's episode tell of such journeys. Our first storyteller, Peggy Nagai, is a powerhouse lawyer, author, speaker, consultant, and activist. She's also a sensei, a person born in the United States whose grandparents immigrated from Japan. In March of 2025, she was honored with the Oregon Commission for Women Lifetime Achievement Award for her tireless work, which notably includes spearheading the team of attorneys representing Minoru Yasui's reopened civil rights case in the early 1980s.
And I turned to men and said, no matter what anyone else does, I would be honored to work on your case. Fighting for justice in a case like yours is exactly why I went to law school.
Listen as Peggy Nagai shares her story, My Self-Honoring Choices.
Stop being that nice Japanese-American girl and come out with your power. Those words offered to me when I was just a few years out of law school by my mentor, Herb, spoke directly to my heart, and I chose a path that I'm still walking today. A few weeks later, I sat on a panel at Minority Law Day, and a fellow Asian American lawyer said, "When I do my hiring, I don't see race or gender. I make my decisions based solely on their legal qualifications." In front of a room full of people, I turned to him and said, "That's bullshit." When people see me, they don't see a lawyer. They see an Asian. They see a woman, but not a lawyer. Even when I'm in the courthouse, wearing a suit and carrying a briefcase, I've been misidentified as a judge's clerk, as a legal secretary, even the defendant, but never a lawyer. Heeding Herb's heartfelt advice and making self-honoring choices about my power has not been easy. I am a U.S.-born Asian-American woman who's felt the pain of anti-Asian racism and discrimination that comes from being marginalized and seen as forever foreign, exotic, erotic, the model minority. I was raised on a farm in Boring, Oregon. My grandfathers immigrated from Japan. My grandmothers came as picture brides because U.S. immigration laws prohibited them from coming in any other way. They and their U.S.-born second-generation Nisei children, my parents, were incarcerated during World War II by the U.S. government. Their government, based on a lie that the Japanese race was an enemy race, and therefore they were either traitors or spies or forever foreign. My parents rarely talked about those dark years and what they learned from that bitter experience. Shigatte ganai, they would say. It can't be helped. Move on. My mother made it clear on how I should behave. Why can't you be more like those nice Japanese American girls? She would ask. I don't know. After high school, I wanted to go to college, but my parents couldn't afford tuition. So I applied for a ton of scholarships, one of which required an interview. So there I was, sitting in a chair, facing two older white men who came from an organization whose membership was all and only white men. One of them asked me, "What do you think about the black student union members at Oregon State who walked off campus in support of Fred Milton, a black athlete?" I needed that scholarship, and I had a pretty good idea of what they wanted to hear. I sat there silent, willing myself to say that I disagreed with the black students. But I couldn't force myself to say it. So instead, I talked about why they were protesting, why it was so important, and how challenging it is to be one of few minority students at Oregon State. I was not awarded that scholarship. I was the valedictorian, and at our high school graduation, instead of giving the traditional thank you to the teachers for our wonderful education, I physically turned the podium to face my fellow students and said, "It's up to us to take this little box of knowledge that we got from high school and do something. Go out, experience the world, change the world. We can do this. We must do this." The next day, my favorite teacher stopped me in the hall. "That was the worst valedictorian speech I've ever heard," he said. "You have to wait until you're in a position of power before you give advice like that." "If I don't state my beliefs now and ask questions," I responded, "I'll never remember what they are when I get there." I was a college student at Vassar, and in the summer, I had a waitressing job at a resort in upstate New York. We got paid by the number of people that sat at our tables. Only problem was the number of people that sat at our tables was determined by the maitre d', who would seat 12 people at one table and two at another. We felt that was unfair. So we were going to go on strike. But before we did that, we had one last conversation with the maitre d'. And he made the situation abundantly clear. "You have no labor laws protecting you. We could fire all of you tomorrow and get a new crew in. And besides, our board of directors is made up of 11 lawyers from New York City. I'd never even met a lawyer. But if they were that powerful, I decided then and there I would go to law school, become a lawyer, and fight for social justice. We didn't strike, but I didn't stay either. I chose to quit, even though I needed the money. I did take that message and learning with me. I graduated from Lewis and Clark Law School and practiced at Legal Aid, representing tenants who were being evicted. I worked at the Urban Indian Council, where I defended people accused of crimes. And then I started a private practice. And it was there that I got to know the Minoru Yasui case that had first started in 1942 and came to me almost 40 years later. In 1942, Congress passed a law, a curfew law, imposing upon all persons of Japanese ancestry, forbidding them from going out of their homes from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. 70% of those folks were U.S. citizens. Minoru Yasui, 25 years old at the time, had graduated from the University of Oregon Law School and was the first Japanese-American member of the Oregon State Bar. He intentionally chose to break the curfew law. He walked the streets of Portland and got himself arrested, believing the courts would vindicate his rights as a United States citizen. Instead, he spent 9 months in solitary confinement in the Multnomah County Jail as his case wended its way to the United States Supreme Court, where he lost. The court said that the curfew was constitutional because it was based on military necessity. 40 years later, documents were found in the National Archives that showed that the decision for the curfew and the incarceration of Japanese Americans was based on race and not military necessity. It also revealed that government attorneys intentionally chose to withhold this critical evidence from the United States Supreme Court. With these documents, Yasui called me and said, "Can you arrange a meeting with Asian American lawyers in Portland to talk about reopening my case?" I was thrilled. After all, Yasui was born in Hood River. He was an Oregonian. He was a native son. And his case could prove that 120,000 Japanese Americans, my family, our community, was unconstitutionally incarcerated based on racial discrimination. I walked into that meeting really excited and was surprised by the response. Some of the Asian American lawyers doubted the validity of the documents that had been found in the National Archives. Others questioned whether we had enough evidence to reopen the case. And still others questioned whether we could win even if the case was reopened. I walked out of there mad, angry, upset, and embarrassed for my generation. And I turned to men and said, "No matter what anyone else does, I would be honored to work on your case. Fighting for justice in a case like yours is exactly why I went to law school." It was while working on the Yasui case that I sat on that panel and shocked the room by my bullshit remark. And it just so happened that Derek Bell, the dean of the University of Oregon Law School, was the keynote speaker. He came up to me at a break and said, gee, it sounds like you'd like to teach law. Hell no, I said. That was the most archaic educational system I've ever been in. It's the last bastion of white male privilege. I was giving up being that nice Japanese-American girl. Several months later, I received a letter from Derek. And he asked me to apply for an assistant dean position that was open at the law school. No other leader in Oregon had given me such an opportunity. Instead, a federal judge had once said to me, come back and talk to me when you're a real lawyer, not one at legal aid. And the United States attorney and the governor of Oregon, in two separate occasions, had said, you're not a real minority because you're an Oriental. Derek Bell was a national leader of color. He'd worked with Thurgood Marshall to bring desegregation cases. He was the first Black tenured professor of Harvard Law School. He's the godfather of critical race theory. And he was the first Black law dean of a mainly white public law school in the history of legal education. I would be honored and proud to work with him. So I applied, and I was thrilled to be offered the position. But I had different priorities. I had become the lead attorney on the Yasui versus United States case. And if I couldn't bring that case with me, I would decline this incredible job offer. Derek understood. Bring your case, bring yourself, come to Eugene. And so I did, and I spent several years working with him. Stepping forward, speaking out, advocating for justice with his full support and confidence. Today, I'm a consultant, and my focus is on leadership, equity, diversity, and inclusion. I had a potential client, a white male senior leader, say to me, Peggy, I understand that diversity is a social issue, but I don't see it as a business issue. We manufacture products. It doesn't matter the race of our employees, nor their gender. What matters is that they're qualified for their job. And if you think otherwise, prove it to me. I didn't accept work from that leader. I do have another client, a white male president of a heavy manufacturing company, who said to me, I want my legacy to be an inclusive workplace where I can encourage my granddaughters to work. I want a diverse workforce that represents the diversity of our community and our country. And I want a place where everyone feels that they belong. I am proud and honored to work with him. After the murders of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and others, I no longer choose to use my life's energy to convince so-called leaders about the importance of inclusion and diversity. I choose to work with true leaders who are bending the arc of justice to inclusive workplaces and asserting their leadership in that process. They may not know how, but they have an abiding commitment to why and what. From there, the how will follow. These have been my self-honoring choices. What are yours? Thank you.
Even after years of practice, it still takes much courage to question and voice the truth in a room full of people who might become uncomfortable or angry as a result. And yet, Peggy continues to honor who she is. As she says, there's just something inside her where she has to speak up. Minoru Yusui once said of his decision to protest the curfew laws, "I felt that we owed at least the obligation as citizens to tell the government they are wrong. That is the sacred duty of every citizen, because what is done to the least of us can be done to all of us." Our next storyteller, Teo Win, was told from a very young age who she was. Because her father was a Black American soldier and her mother was Vietnamese, she was told she did not belong in Vietnam, and she was ridiculed incessantly. But as a young child, she made a decision. Instead of dropping out of school like many mixed-race children in Vietnam had done to avoid the bullying, she stayed in school, despite the exclusion and mockery, and immersed herself in her studies.
Studying was my only safe place, my only place to escape from those who looked down on me. My mom wanted me to go to school, but my stepdad didn't. So every day after school, I would hide from him in a quiet corner and do my homework by myself.
Teo, with her mom's encouragement, knew education was the path beyond others' expectations, into a life that she could define for herself. Listen as she tells her story, "I Do Belong Here."
Growing up in Vietnam, I never felt like I belonged. In my heart, when I think about my childhood, I cry inside. My dad was a Black American soldier. He and my mom were happy together. They lived in Cam Ranh Bay, about a five-hour drive north of Saigon. There was a huge American base there, and many of the soldiers formed relationships with local women. When my mom was pregnant with me in 1971, my dad's tour of duty ended, and he was sent back to the U.S. He wanted my mom to come with him, but she had three kids already from her previous marriage. My dad had met those kids, and he said supporting them would be too much for him. But my mom would never abandon her kids, so he left her behind and returned to the U.S. without her. After I was born, she sent him pictures of me, and they went back and forth with letters until the war was over in 1975. After that, they lost touch. When I was four, the communists entered our area, and we ran south to the place near Saigon. I remember I had no shoes and had to run on hot sand. I was thirsty, hungry. We slept on the beach, and there were airplanes overhead. It was terrifying. After the war, we returned to our town, but everything was gone. All our things had been taken, and we had to start over. By then, my mom had remarried, and we lived with our small family. My mom, stepdad, my older sister, my younger brother, and me. Our parents walked to the mountain every day to do farming. I never met my grandparents, my mother's parents. They lived in another town, and she sometimes visited them, but she never took me with her to see them. She told me they did not want to see me because I was a mixed-race kid. Mixed-race kids were not welcome in Vietnam, no matter if your mix was Black Vietnamese or White Vietnamese. If your skin did not look Vietnamese, you were not accepted. In our neighborhood, when I walk on the street, kids would shout, "Hey, you Black, hey, you American, you don't belong here. Go to your own country." Kids would follow me on the street and make up songs to mock me. I felt like they were trying to make me into some type of strange creature, not even human. Kids would pull my long fluffy hair. They said it looked like a rambutan, a fruit we have in Vietnam that is covered in a hard shell with many stringy hairs on the outside. When this kind of thing happened, I just give those kids a dirty look and keep walking. My whole life in Vietnam, people who did not know me would say bad things to me. But I was a child. I couldn't speak up. Inside, I would say, "Okay, you have no idea who I really am." But in my heart, of course, I felt the pain every time. My mom would say, "It doesn't matter how people treat you. God knows everything. You just do what you need to do. Why worry about them?" Most mixed-race kids dropped out of school because it was so terrible to be mocked all the time. But I knew educated people were somebody in Vietnam. So I decided I would find a way to be treated better by having an education. I planned to be an attorney or a nurse. I saw many people treated unfairly, so I wanted to be a lawyer and fight for them. I was good at debating and writing, so attorney was my first choice. Or I thought I could be a nurse and help people that way. Studying was my only safe place, my only place to escape from those who looked down on me. My mom wanted me to go to school, but my stepdad didn't. So every day after school, I would hide from him in a quiet corner and do my homework by myself. At the end of every school year, the school would have a ceremony, and if you were a top student, they would call you up to the front of the whole school and present you with a certificate of excellence. I got good grades, but I never got a certificate. Until one teacher, our sixth grade teacher, spoke up for me. That year, I got really sick and missed school for a couple of weeks. When I was home in bed, I heard that teacher's voice outside. He had found my house and came to talk to my mom. After that, I got a certificate for excellence every year. In In 1989, a man came to our house looking for kids like me. He told us that the Admiration Homecoming Act was passed to allow 23,000 biracial kids from Vietnam to come to the U.S. He explained that we should file paperwork for my mom, my younger brother, and me to go. My other brother and sisters were older and had their own families, so they could not come. I knew a lot of Vietnamese had tried to go to the U.S., and some even tried to go by dangerous trips in boats. So I thought America must be like heaven. A rich place, a place where you could earn money, a place where they would accept me. People always call me American, so I believe I was one of them. I left Vietnam when I was in grade 11. We flew to the Philippines and stayed in a refugee camp there for 6 months to learn English and wait for a sponsor. A church from Portland sponsored us. We arrived in Portland in July, but it felt cold and sad and quiet compared to Vietnam. It was beautiful, with big trees and clean streets, but there were no people in sight, and lots of cars. But I didn't mind. Here, at least, there were no kids on the road to mock me. But we were fine. We lived in the attic of the pastor of our church and shared a kitchen with other people. My mom washed dishes at Vietnamese restaurant. And as refugees, we got some government assistance at first. In school, I felt like I didn't belong because I could not speak English and I was a teenager without the right clothes. But no one said, "You don't belong here. Go back to your own country." People would look at me a little differently, but they didn't point at me. I met a couple of friends that I am still in touch with, and my ESL teachers was very helpful. I especially read math tests with word problems. I couldn't figure them out fast enough. So the teacher would call in a Vietnamese-speaking tutor to help me to translate them. I graduated from high school with honors. And went to PCC Slovenia for an associate degree. I didn't feel confident enough with my English to be a lawyer in this country. But I finished prerequisites courses for nursing and decided to be a dental hygienist. I got my bachelor in dental hygiene at Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls. In 1999, about 10 years after I left, I returned to Vietnam to see my brother and sisters and nieces and nephews there. It was wonderful to be with my family again, and I didn't care if the people in my town accepted me or treated me well. That didn't matter, because I knew I had an education, I had make money, and I was finally somebody. I was so happy to get together with my old friends and take them out for a special meal. But when some of the old neighbor who never even used to talk to me or my mom invited me to their houses. I don't want to waste my time with them. I could see people like that suddenly treated me well only because I live in America now and have an education. In other words, those people only respected me because they thought I was rich, not because of who I am. I am a Black American who was born in Vietnam. I am Vietnamese, but I don't belong there. I'm the child of an American dad, even though I never met him and he left me behind. I'm proud of who I am, no matter where I am.
April 30th, 2025 was the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. When I asked Hale how she felt about this, she responded, "It doesn't matter the year. I always feel sorrow." These days, Teo is raising twin teenage boys with her husband and working as a dental hygienist. Of her work, she says, "I'm not just doing teeth. I'm helping patients with life." That's just her spirit. Teo also prioritizes her own healing. She spends time in nature, nourishes her relationship with God and her community, exercises every day, and continues to share her story, not only verbally on stage, as you've just heard, but also through her website and blog, AmerAsianLife.com. She is also currently at work on a memoir. Once told who she was, Teo now defines herself. She says, "I am a hard worker. I am a helper. I am a survivor. I am strong." And if I may add, she is an example to us all. Our final storyteller is Toby Asai Loftus, who explores his personal struggle with what it means to be multiracial. Toby calls himself Japanese American, although in his words, he inherited his father's height, pale skin, and Western eyes. How do you embrace the part of your ancestry everyone sees on the outside, but that you least identify with on the inside and feel conflicted about? Toby's story is in part a story of his father, and how father and son bonded greatly with their shared love for music.
When I was in junior high and high school, Dad and I played dinner music in a local restaurant. He played piano and accordion, and I played flute and violin. And as we played, our eyes would meet, and we'd smile.
Listen in as Toby shares Discovering My Story.
It took me 18 years to realize and embrace what I am. For as long as I can remember, I've heard stories about my mom's life growing up in Hood River. Her parents were immigrants from Japan, and during World War II, the entire family was forced from their home and behind barbed wire. Over 120,000 Japanese Americans were forced into concentration camps for over 3 years. Most never spoke of their experience and are known as the Silent Generation. Fortunately, my mom spoke up. She's been giving talks about Japanese American incarceration for as long as I can remember. There's a grainy newspaper photograph of her in camp. She's in a Christmas pageant and she's dressed as an angel and she's holding a microphone. She likes to joke that once she was given a mic, she didn't stop talking. Thank goodness for that. She tells a story about Mrs. Bettsworth, who, before the war, offered Mom milk and cookies and invited her to play on her tire swing. After the war, every day, when my mom walked past Mrs. Bettsworth's house on her way to and from school, Mrs. Bettsworth would come to the road, sick her dog on her, and shout, Why don't you go back where you came from, you dirty yellow Jap? She talks about social isolation. On recess, on the playground, few kids would play with her. In high school, no one would dance with her. Even in church, no one would sit on the same pew with her. She contemplated suicide. She hated being Japanese, and so in the ninth grade, without telling anyone in her family, she changed her name from Mitsuko to Mitzi. My parents met at a college friend's party. They couldn't have looked more different. My father, with Norwegian, German, and English blood, stood 14 inches taller than my mom. They both loved children, but they contemplated having none. They were worried their mixed-race children might face the kind of racism and social isolation that my mom suffered. But they had three boys, and I'm the youngest. I inherited my father's height, pale skin, and Western eyes. I called myself Japanese American, but I don't look Japanese. My middle name, Asai, is my mom's Japanese family name. When I was very young, she taught me how to write it in kanji, and she has papers from elementary school where I've signed my name, Toby Asai Loftus. I called myself Japanese, but I don't look Japanese. And I grew up far from my mom's family. Every year, maybe once a year, we drive up to Hood River. And I can remember from a very early age admiring and envying the beautiful almond-shaped eyes of my cousins. I thought they were beautiful. In contrast, I felt like mine were tired and saggy. They all knew my grandparents, but I'm the youngest of the generation. I never got to meet them. I longed to know more about them and to further embrace my Japanese heritage. Growing up in Coos Bay, I remember hearing jokes about Japs and Chinks. I'd speak up and say, "You know, I'm half Japanese." "Yeah, but you're different." As if that makes it okay. I'd see kids pull their eyes back to make fun of Asians, and inside I seethed, but I also felt conflicted. The eyes that they were mocking were the kind of eyes that I wished I had. There was another boy who was half Japanese. He looked Asian, and he was heavy set. He was teased and bullied mercilessly. I was disgusted. But to my shame, I said and did nothing. I hid behind my pale skin and Western eyes so as not to become a target. My father was warm, generous, and supportive. He was a professional musician and music instructor. And when I was 4 years old, he placed a tiny violin into my little stubby hands, thus launching me on a lifetime musical journey. As a family, we played string quartets together. My brothers and I played the violin, my mom played the cello, and my father played the viola. When I was in junior high and high school, Dad and I played dinner music in a local restaurant. He played piano and accordion, and I played flute and violin. And as we played, our eyes would meet, and we'd smile. When I graduated from high school, my mom encouraged me to always check the box for Japanese American on my scholarship and college entrance forms. She thought it might increase my chances. I was accepted to Brown University and attended a pre-orientation program for students of color. We separated into four groups: the African Americans, the Asian Americans, the Latinos, and the multiracial group. I gravitated to the large Asian American group. On the last day of the program, each group got up and gave presentations. Most of them were silly skits and jokes, making fun of racial stereotypes we hear every day. I was in a silly skit about a group of competition eaters called the Flying Chopsticks. Then the multiracial group got up. Instead of jokes or silly skits, each student stood up and stepped forward and spoke from the heart about what it meant to them to be multiracial. They talked about love, overcoming fear, ignorance, and hatred. I was very moved, but also conflicted. I should have been in that group. At that moment, I finally had awakened to the truth I had avoided all my life. I suppressed that part that I inherited from my loving father, except when it served or protected me. I could hardly rush back to my dorm room fast enough to call him up. I'm sorry for all those times I called myself Japanese American. I never acknowledged you or what you gave me. He just chuckled, "Don't worry about it. I'm just proud of you." Years later, I was down in Coos Bay for the weekend visiting my folks. As usual, Dad and I played music together for hours. We played our favorite Mozart piano and violin sonatas and Fritz Kreisler schmaltz. And as we played, our eyes met and he smiled. Monday morning, before I started the long drive home, I gave Dad a big hug goodbye. When I got home to Portland, there was a message on my answering machine. Dad had been hit by a drunk driver and was being transferred to Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. This was not good. It must have been serious. I quickly showered, repacked my bags, grabbed my violin, and started the drive back down to Eugene. Dad was in a coma. Friends and family collected, holding hands, telling stories, hoping and praying Dad would wake up. I pulled out my violin and started playing all those old tunes he and I had played together in a restaurant years ago. I was hoping he'd wake up and our eyes would meet and we'd smile. But he never did. I was holding one of his large, gentle hands in mine when he drew his final breath. I was devastated. Of course, I lost and missed my father, but even more, I missed that deep, emotional, intimate, spiritual connection I felt with him when we played music together. A year after he died, I started looking for other musicians to play with. At my company, I posted a sign on the wall. Does anybody else play the violin? Two violinists showed up, so we started playing trios together. Then a cellist showed up. Mom, next time you come to Portland, could you bring Dad's viola and some easy string quartet music? Dad's viola was an inferior cheap musical instrument. But I fell in love with its rich, dark tones. I started getting invited to play in chamber groups and orchestras much more frequently than I ever did on the violin. When people ask me now, "What do you do?" I say, "I support my viola habit working in high tech." Viola has become my primary instrument. I've been playing in the Newport Symphony for over 20 years now. I'm loving playing music now as much as I ever have in my entire life. I can only imagine what Dad would say. I've been learning more about my Japanese family heritage. Mom and I have made several trips to Japan, and we've collected stories and photographs and spent hours poring over our Japanese family tree. Mom's 92, and she's still giving talks. And she just published a book. With her blessing, I've begun giving talks about Japanese American incarceration myself. I've also been learning more about my European heritage. My last name, Loftus, comes from a Norwegian town called Lofthus. Although I found out we actually came from another town called Hjartdal. A former Norwegian exchange student friend of mine visited me over Christmas. She gave me a book with pictures showing traditional Norwegian folk costumes, and she marked the page from the Telemark region where my family is from. She's invited me to come, and you know I can't wait to go. I'm creating my own story, and I embrace the responsibility of keeping the stories of both my parents alive. Now when I have a form to fill out, if I can't check multiple boxes, or if there's no box for two or more races, I leave that question blank. I can't believe how often that still happens. I've come to peace with my unique identity. I'm Japanese American, but I don't look Japanese. I look white, but I'm not really white. I'm proud of my unique, rich blend. I am a multiracial American.
Toby's mother, Mitzi, is still going strong. In her early 90s, she is known to take long rides on the back of a tandem bike. Her love for life is inspiring. Toby's passion for music, which he once shared with his father, will forever be an integral part of his life. He continues to play the viola in the Newport Symphony Orchestra. Since college, Toby has felt a great responsibility. He says, "I am a white passing, tall, cis straight male. How do I use that privilege? How do I advocate for racial justice?" One way to advocate for justice is by sharing our stories, just as Toby, Teo, and Peggy have here. Our storytellers asked the difficult questions, ignored the discouragement or disbelief, and forged a path of their own. Sure, they may have made mistakes along the way, just as we all do, but they stayed the course, which is never the easiest way. Each of our storytellers today have defined who they are and what their stories mean. And our world is better for it. The Immigrant Story Live is a production of The Immigrant Story. This episode was hosted, produced, and edited by me, Meg Ritter. Storyboard was edited by Fran Silverman and Deegan Larkin, with audio post-production by Greg Palmer. Our executive producer is Sankar Raman. All stories were part of I'm an American Live, a series of storytelling events showcasing Asian American voices, staged at the Patricia Research Center for the Performing Arts in Beaverton, Oregon. If you want to catch up on our past live events, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at The Immigrant Story Live. This episode is part of the Oregon Rises Above Hate series, generously funded by Ann Nato Campbell. For more stories, visit theimmigrantstory.org/manyroads. Listen live at prp.fm or stream us wherever you get your podcasts.